Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Christopher Lindholz, CEO and co-founder of Metronaps. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you, Matt. Nice to be here.
So kind of the first thing I always like to do with all my guests is to give you the chance to provide a little bit more of a background as to who you are and what you do. So Christopher, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Christopher Lindholz. I am co-founder and CEO of Metronaps. We started Metronaps about 15 years ago because we saw people falling asleep at work, and we wanted to find a solution for that. And today, we provide solutions to a variety of industries, basically focused on short rest in the workplace. So we deliver solutions to corporations, universities, and of course, also the healthcare industry.
So kind of in identifying the issue around people falling asleep or not having enough sleep, are you by your kind of natural tendency a napper?
It turned out that I am. I didn't realize that so much until we started Metronaps. But what I found out actually was that naps helped me a great deal. Everybody has a natural dip in the afternoon as part of your circadian rhythm. Everybody's experienced it. Some people, they power through with coffee. Some people power through with sugar. And I found that naps are really helpful to me. I've honed my skills at napping, so I'm down to a 14-minute nap. And that proves really useful in terms of maintaining my energy, both for getting stuff done at work, but then also so I have more energy when I get home to be with my family. I have two young boys and a wife, and I prefer to be in a good mood when I get home.
You know, that is very fair. With young kids, it definitely takes a lot of energy. I am in the same boat, although not in the same boat in terms of being a napper. So I'm interested by the fact that you kind of phrased it as you've refined your skill of being able to do it. So can you kind of provide a little bit more insight into what you mean by the skill of napping?
Well, sleep and napping is a skill that we all latently have, but not everybody has bothered to hone. And, it's a little bit like tennis. If you've never tried playing tennis, you're not likely to be very good at it the first time you do it. But if you practice, you can get better at it. And napping is very similar. You can essentially prepare yourself for it, and with different cues and with some practice, it becomes a more natural thing for you to do. So even if you don't consider yourself a napper, I would say, give me a chance. I'm sure that we could get you there, and I'm sure you would find it helpful.
So what are some of the strategies that are effective for improving both the quality and ability to nap?
Well, very simply, again, it's very similar to sleep, is that you establish and maintain a routine that essentially you do the same thing every time. So ideally, when you go to sleep at night, you would like to have a routine in which you do the same things. So whether it's you have your favorite set of pajamas, maybe you read, maybe you take a bath. These kinds of things become cues for you for your brain to realize now is when I need to get some sleep. And the same is true for napping. So if you have an environment that you and a routine for that, and we have a solution specifically designed. That's one of our flagship products is our Energy Pod, which is a device for napping. But that is, it creates an environment that's always the same, and through the use of both positioning the body and also listening to the same music, you create these cues, which are signals to your brain that this is when I want to do this. And that's basically how you train yourself to become effective at it.
Yeah, so I think, as you were saying, the consistency is the key, both in terms of environment and cues that I think you were describing that each individual will develop.
Yeah, it's not actually particularly complicated. It's just it's requires discipline, and it can be difficult to do because of our busy lives. And that's probably the toughest part of it.
Picking up on the point, which you said, that, busy lives and I think probably cultural pressures against, taking the breaks in the middle of the day, are you seeing changes in that regard that show a greater recognition for the benefit of getting these short periods of rest?
Well, when we started over 15 years ago, people thought we were crazy to be promoting sleeping on the job. And it has taken that long in order to change that stigma. And it's still out there, but there's a much greater awareness of the importance of sleep. And consequently, also the understanding that short sleep during the day can also be beneficial. So we still have our challenges in terms of getting people to understand this. But certainly a lot has happened in this time period that I've been involved in the sleep industry, where people have really begun to understand that there is a value in this, that it has a positive impact on people's performance. It has a positive impact on people's long-term well-being. So we've made a lot of progress.
And what are some of the factors that are making the positive impact? You know, kind of what, from your perspective, what is driving the change in perspective?
Well, I think one way to look at this is, what are the negative factors that impact an individual when they're not getting a sufficient amount of sleep and they're not able to take these short rest sessions? And we know that the consequences are significant and severe, both in terms of cognitive performance and also in terms of long-term health and well-being. So if you're not getting enough sleep, you're not likely to perform particularly well at concentration. You're less able to cope with stress, because when we're tired, our coping mechanisms are generally reduced. You're more likely to be in a poor mood, because when we're tired, we tend to be grumpy. You are more likely to take rash and rash decisions, and often decisions that might actually be dishonest. So you're much more likely to steal, for example, if you're fatigued, amazingly. So there are a lot of consequences to not sleeping properly. And I think within that, lies the reason for why it becomes important to actually get this done. And that is because you can reduce all those things by getting sufficient sleep. And also you can mitigate fatigue in the short instance by taking these brief periods of rest during the day as well.
So, and I think you've kind of used that phrase a couple times in, you know, saying short periods of rest. So, you know, is there data or evidence around an ideal length for a nap?
There's a great deal, yes. A sleep cycle is approximately 90 minutes in length. And we know that if we keep an individual in the lighter stages of sleep, then we can essentially get them right back to work with a limited amount of what's called sleep inertia or grogginess. So napping for longer periods of time isn't necessarily bad for you, but it will take you longer to snap back to full concentration. So that period of optimal rest is typically about 20 minutes. There are studies that have shown naps as brief as 6 minutes have cognitive benefit. So we're talking about a short period of time between 6 minutes and about 20 minutes. So it's not very long.
Yeah, and kind of, you know, with that period of time, you know, I think as you're suggesting, it can easily fit into a work schedule. And, you know, as you're pointing out, using kind of the negative impact to emphasize the positive, you know, if you can increase productivity and quality and efficiency, then, you know, kind of sacrifice, you know, arguably sacrificing that brief period of time has a much bigger payoff in the long run.
And I think the other aspects of, so often people will, in certain environments, will anyway have scheduled breaks. So it's really about giving them an opportunity to do something constructive and effective during that break. And so having a space where you can actually go rest would be one of those things. I like to compare it to smoking. So we know that smoking's not good for you. People can choose to smoke anyway. But if the average smoker goes and takes a smoke break 3 or 4 times a day, and that these days they have to, you know, go down the elevator, out the building, and 100 yards down the street before they're even allowed to do it, that's going to take way more than 15 minutes during the course of the day to do that. So if that's acceptable, even though we try to encourage people not to smoke, but it's still, people still do it. If that's okay, then certainly being able to take a short nap should be able to be okay as well, because we know that that's actually good for you and it improves your productivity.
You know, I think that's a very fair point. It's, you know, kind of if a cultural acceptance had developed around permitting an activity that is negative for health, it would seem to be a much easier battle to promote an activity that has positive impacts both on health and on the workplace.
But we have 200 years of industrialization that we have to turn back the clock on here. And so it is still a tall order, and it will take some time before everybody fully gets it. But like I said, we're making progress.
So is there, you know, and I feel like this maybe is more anecdotal, but it, you know, is there any benefit in terms of comparing to, you know, countries that, you know, I think like Spain, where, you know, there's the concept of the siesta, and it's, you know, you end up with a break in the middle of the day, whether or not, you know, not sure if that actually still occurs or not, but it's certainly something that I think is, you know, in a popular lexicon. So, you know, are there any benefits for comparing to practices like that?
Well, I think there are, and you've highlighted some interesting cultural aspects. The siesta is one of them. We try not actually to compare it to the siesta, because the siesta is was a longer cultural phenomenon, which that also involved a break from work and going home for lunch and so forth, and getting out of the sun, the hot Spanish sun and so forth. So it's not actually really the same thing as a brief power nap. But you can certainly compare to, we see in a lot of Asian cultures where it is standard practice for an organization to essentially shut down just after lunch, and people literally put their heads on their desk for 15 minutes, and the whole organization takes a break. You know, from a cultural perspective and also from a productivity perspective, it's both well documented and well understood in those cultures. So it's really in Western culture that we have this hurdle, this kind of Protestant work ethic that we have to overcome, and the industrialization that's occurred over several centuries and changed the way that we perceived this brief rest that's actually we're pre-programmed to do, we've just been told to ignore.
No, thank you for kind of level setting the comparison, because it's you know, I think as you pointed out, very useful to actually have an appropriate measurement point. But you know, it kind of, I think going back a little bit in terms of, you know, the ability for a cultural change to occur, you know, do you have any specific examples, I guess primarily within the US, where there is maybe a better recognition from the employer side of the benefits?
Well, we know a number of organizations, and I think, you know, perhaps the best reference is really just to see how our own business has grown over that period of time, because employers of all different types and also providers like universities have accepted this and understood the benefits. And so in a way that speaks for itself, because we see that people have taken this on, and we know that it has a benefit. There's massive scientific evidence for why this would be beneficial. So it was really a question of taking something that has already been researched and kind of hidden in a bunch of papers that nobody wanted to read, and taking it and making it, putting it into practice and making it, providing a solution. Because it's one thing to say you should do it, it's another to actually create an environment in which it's possible to do it. And those two things are not the same.
Yes, no, and I think kind of as you're saying, it's, you know, just getting more emphasis around it. And it's, and it actually, you know, as we're talking, it reminds me of, you know, I'm in Massachusetts, and over the summer, I recall an article in the Boston Globe about the fact that the Boston Red Sox had installed a napping room for the players because they found that, I think, some of the players were wanting to get that period of rest leading up to a game, because they found that it helped with their performance. And, you know, I kind of recall that the reactions weren't like in the vein of, I can't believe they're doing that, so much as, I'm a little jealous that my workplace doesn't have something like that.
We see lots of athletic teams, and we have lots of them that are our clients. They are implementing these solutions in order to improve player performance. And it's very simple. If you practice something in the morning and you sleep on it briefly, your memory consolidates, both your cognitive memory, but also your muscle memory. So if you're practicing your forehand, if I may use a tennis example again, in the morning, it will be better in the afternoon if you take a nap versus if you don't.
Yeah, and for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Christopher Lindholz from MetroNaps. We're talking about the benefits of napping and you know, the ability to improve you know, both overall health and productivity. And Christopher, so far we've been talking a lot about just kind of the generalized benefits of napping, but, you know, kind of at the beginning you said that you're starting to have a focus on healthcare. So, you know, moving from the broad general discussion that we've been having, you know, into the healthcare industry specifically, are you seeing any unique challenges in getting recognition of giving individuals the opportunity to get these brief periods of rest?
Well, certainly within the healthcare industry, there is, of course, a tradition of people working very long hours. And that's both it poses both a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. We know that people who are awake and alert for very long periods of time have diminished cognitive functionality. So the National Sleep Foundation, for example, recently came out with a recommendation that anybody who's been awake for 22 hours shouldn't be operating a motorized vehicle. And part of what drives that is studies that show that anybody who's been awake for that long is performing at the same cognitive impairment as if they're intoxicated. So if we don't want people operating a motorized vehicle at after 22 hours of wakefulness, you know, I think the healthcare industry also needs to ask itself, do we want that same person potentially administering medicine or treating a patient in that cognitive state?
No, and I think that's a very fair point. And probably also realistically, it is a multiple combination of those factors, because it's, you know, one, not only is it a actual question, as you said, do we want clinicians or others who've had that period of wakefulness treating patients, but then kind of carrying it forward of thinking about how they get home, you know, more likely than not, in most parts of the country, they're then having to drive home, which, you know, then directly correlates to the findings of the study that you're just referencing.
You're exactly right. And, you know, we can, to bring some international context in, we see, for example, in the United Kingdom, the National Health Service has implemented facilities specifically because they're targeting fatigue and accidents following a long shift. They've had issues with that, and they're trying to mitigate essentially that the people who are supposed to be taking care of us are, you know, killing themselves on the way home.
Yes. No, and obviously, you know, that's an outcome that I don't think anyone wants, but, you know, kind of thinking about the ability to change it, you know, I think you're kind of implicitly saying, you know, that there are very deeply embedded kind of expectations of, you know, one called generation of the workforce has had to go through this, and the feeling of, well, if I did it, you know, why shouldn't the new generation have to do it?
Well, you're right, and I would say this isn't different than any other industry. So we have some embedded understandings that we think we need to shift, and the best way to do that is to look at the existing research support and actually implement some solutions and show that there is, in fact, a benefit and an impact by making these instruments. And there is already ample evidence that that's the case.
Yeah, so kind of on top of the evidence, you know, are you able to point to particular healthcare systems or organizations that are maybe playing a leading edge in shifting the culture on this issue within healthcare?
Well, again, we're privileged to operate in lots of countries. And so I can give you some contact also, again, international. But one example that I think is very relevant and is in the Netherlands in Europe, where several organizations, they have started implementing for the night shift in particular, a regimen of different solutions, which includes glasses to help shift circadian rhythm, changing the diet of people working the night shift. So trying to get away from carbohydrates and focusing more on fruit, for example, and then also giving people a nap opportunity during the night shift, either at the end of it or during it. And what they've shown by doing so is that they have drastically reduced absenteeism, and they've also significantly improved the workers, their own perception of well-being and, you know, essentially their satisfaction with going to work. So they've created this virtuous circle that's actually freed up additional budget for them so that they can continue to invest in these people. And that's being implemented across the country. And I think those kinds of findings are relevant for certainly in the US, but what's important about them is it's not particularly complicated to do, actually. We're not talking about significant physical interventions. We're talking about a change in mindset. That's actually the hardest thing.
And actually, I think you just introduced a kind of a new element that we hadn't necessarily touched on, which are some of the other pieces of the puzzle. You know, I think you mentioned diet, and for people working, you know, an overnight shift, you know, to create different perceptions. So it kind of helps, I think it sounds like, almost shift their biological response to what time of day they're working.
Well, it's right, and it needs to be done. It's well documented that shift work and night work is unfortunately inherently unhealthy for us. And one of the ironies of the healthcare industry is that these are people who are taking care of the rest of us and ideally should know, and the entire industry should know what's good for people. But in fact, they often end up having fairly unhealthy jobs because of this, you know, the night shift work. So chronic sleep deprivation has severe both cognitive impact, but also physical impact on our health. And there are things you can do to mitigate for this. And like I said, they're not necessarily super complicated.
And you just mentioned a term, chronic sleep deprivation. What constitutes chronic sleep deprivation?
Well, there's some different definitions of it, but you know, generally speaking, we're talking about somebody who's consistently not getting the right amount of sleep for them. And each person is a little bit different in terms of how much sleep they actually need, but most people will be familiar with the you know, the 8 hour amount of time that we've typically heard from sleep experts say that that's the amount of sleep that you should be getting within a 24 hour period or at night. We also know that if you get less than 6 hours of sleep consistently, the vast majority of people will suffer significantly from that, both in terms of cognition and also physical condition. So consistently getting not enough sleep is essentially what chronic sleep deprivation is. And again, there's plenty of research that shows that this has a negative impact both on your ability to perform and also your long-term health.
So when you're in a state of sleep deprivation, you know, is it that you can, you know, kind of make up the amount of sleep that you're missing, or what happens to get you out of that state of deprivation?
So that's an interesting question, because there's a lot of discussion about whether or not you can ever really make up for the sleep that you haven't gotten. And, you know, essentially we say that if you didn't get some sleep, it's essentially too late. You can't get it again. You can make up for short-term deficits in sleep. So we've all tried maybe where we were up a night or something and we didn't get enough sleep, and then we sleep a lot the following day. But if you do this on a consistent basis, that sleep debt that you've essentially accumulated, you'll never be able to repay it. And we're only really beginning to understand what the long-term consequences on our health are going to be from that. It might take a full generation before we really see how bad the impact of that sort of sleep deprivation is. And we're actually sleeping less and less, so it's only going to get worse.
No, that's very interesting. It's, you know, I think consistent with you know, the statements that are, I think, becoming more frequent, you know, which, as you said, is, you know, once you've lost it, you've lost it, and no matter what you do, you can't make it up. It's kind of more in the vein of recognize the issue and improve going forward, so you don't keep making the issue worse.
And it doesn't have to be so difficult either to do this. I mean, small changes in your routine and regime related to this can have a big impact. So again, it requires some discipline in order to do this. You know, we have to get people away from binge watching three series of whatever on Netflix or the like, instead of getting their sleep. So there's lots of temptations. There's lots of, and work is, if not a temptation, then often something that gets in the way of us getting our sleep. But sleep is something we have to prioritize.
No, and I think that's a very good point. It's, you know, there, kind of as you're referencing, there are so many different opportunities and means for doing something that kind of suck you in, especially technology related. And then the next thing you know, it's been, you know, hours have gone by, and you know, the common reaction is, oh, I should have just gone to sleep instead of doing that.
It's easy to do. And again, it's, you know, it's one of those things that's easier said than done. It really does require, you know, within, as an individual and perhaps within a family, to set some rules around how you're going to relate to this technology, and also how you're going to prioritize one of these, this very important pillar of health, which is sleep.
Yes, I definitely agree. And it's, you know, kind of that point about discipline. It's, you know, I think about my own household where we're very disciplined with our children, and it's, you know, you go to sleep at this time every single night, and, you know, unless it's some really special occasion, we don't deviate, and then they get much better sleep than we do. But Christopher, as amazing, we are already running towards the end of our time. I'd like to ask you one Final question, which is, you know, based on everything that we've been talking about, kind of ideally, you know, how would you like to implement or see implemented a better balance between work and the ability to get appropriate rest?
Well, I think it requires a combination of interventions, and some of it is potentially regulatory. So actually looking at how long are people allowed to work for and creating some frameworks that are reasonable. There are some existing frameworks. I think those should be probably tightened up a bit because they are at the extremes. But at least we're talking about setting some limitations, and there are some in place. So, you know, from that perspective, progress has been made. But ultimately, I think it really comes down to the individual being aware of how important this is. And so education about this is vital, and getting the word out to, you know, everyone, essentially, that this is something that they need to do something about and focus on and not take it for granted. And essentially do what you just said you do for your children, which is to make sure they go to bed every night. Only adults actually do that. We would all benefit from going to bed at the same time every night. That's part of a good sleep routine. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that difficult. It is possible.
And as I mentioned, believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Christopher Lindholz, for a great conversation today.
Thank you, Matt.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.